Welcome to the latest episode of Walkabout Talkabouts. My name is David Wyatt, here with Mighty Coconut. We have our friends from the Strong Museum of Play here to talk all things mini golf and play. So with that, take it away, Andrew.
Sure. So I'm Andrew. I'm the Director of Digital Preservation here at the Strong. So I help preserve all sorts of video games, both new, old, everything in between.
Very, very cool.
And excellent. I'm Chris. I'm Vice President for Collections, but I'm also Chief Curator for the whole museum. So that's about 500,000 artifacts and resources. And I'm thrilled to have such a great team of people to work with, folks like Andrew, that make coming to work fun almost every day. Not every day, but most days.
Definitely most days.
Well, if you can't have fun at a museum of play, I guess, but all work is work at some point, you know, certainly.
Right.
We get it for sure. All right, well, let's go ahead and get on into it. Take your best shot, Andrew. Well, I'm so curious to hear. I guess first, you know, I've become familiar, but for our viewers, tell us about the Strong Museum of Play, what you guys are all about, how you got started, and then obviously we want to hear about the mini golf exhibition that's coming up.
Well, the museum opened to the public in 1982, and back then we were all about how everyday Americans live. And since then, we have really changed our emphasis in 2002 to be all about how people play. And we found that that has been incredibly successful for us. All right. Okay. Had to get my.
Well, and for those that don't know, you all are located in upstate New York, correct?
Right. We are about an hour and a half from Niagara Falls, and my line is always come see two wonders of the world, Niagara Falls and the Strong National Museum of Play.
Excellent. And how many, give us a sense of, you talked about 500,000 items in the collection, how large by square feet, or how do you sort of measure the size? It seems immense.
Sure. We are 400,000 square feet. And we welcome, this year we're expecting 750,000 people to come to the museum. So incredible. We are a big place with lots of things to do, and we couldn't be a museum of play without chances to play.
Sure, yeah. Definitely. Well, and so when you all talk about play, is it just like what we traditionally think of as like childlike play, or sort of what's your take on play as the museum of play?
We have been very careful not to define play. So play is sort of what you make of it. So for instance, I love to garden, but if you told me to dig a ditch, I would feel really cranky about that.
Yeah.
But if you tell me I'm going to plant 500 daffodil bulbs, and I'm the one who's decided to do that, that's play for me. And even though it looks exactly like work. So play, one of the key things is it's got to be self-directed. It's got to be your choice, not somebody imposing it on you.
I think that's what makes us so much fun so much of the time is that, you know, no matter what exhibits we do, everybody comes into it with their own idea of what play is. So, you know, we try to predict how people are going to use our exhibits, but then they surprise us with, you know, things that we never expected. And, you know, seeing the generational links, we like to say that, you know, play is universal. It's for kids of all ages. Seeing the grandparents, the parents with their kids, grandkids, I think it's just an incredible experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I come from an art museum background where it's sort of like, don't touch, you know, stand back. And I would imagine you all are extremely hands-on in many cases.
Absolutely. I mean, all of we're a collections-based museum, so a lot of it starts with the collections objects. Then we add in the interpretation of those objects. But then every gallery, every exhibit that we do has some sort of interactivity. Now, that can vary depending on the exhibit itself. Some are more focused on the interactivity, some are less focused. But even in the case, so we have over 65,000 video game related objects, about 400 arcade and pinball machines. We actually call the arcade games and pinball machines USAFacts. The idea is that they're artifacts that you're actually going to get to interact with, you're going to play, because I think that's the best way of doing it. It would be a whole lot less fun if you came to a play museum and couldn't play with any of the stuff.
Oh, it'd be probably frustrating, right? There's a little bit of cognitive dissonance there. So I know you all have, you know, all kinds of toys in your collection, but video games is a big, big piece of that. Sort of, is it hardware, software, all of the above?
It's definitely all of the above and everything else that you could possibly imagine related to video games. So we look at it as, you know, the video games are at the center of everything, right? You need the games, mm-hmm. you need the hardware. If you're going to collect video games, you need that stuff. But beyond that, we're looking at the producers, the people making the games. You know, how can mm-hmm. we show the behind the scenes? You know, think about how this game was made, the VR technology, all that went into it. That's just as important. So yes, we have the museum collection, but then we also have the library and archives. So the archives is where you'd see that sort of thing. But then you talk about the library, and that's where things like books that are being written about video games, magazines about video games, all that stuff is important. But then you also think about the player experience too. Like, what is it like to play this game now versus, you know, a golf game 15, 20 years ago? How does cosplay differ than streaming? How does that differ from, you know, a kid that's just playing a video game? So the player experience is part of it too. And then with video games, because we're not a video game museum, we're looking at it through that lens of play. How do video games fit into the overall narrative of what play is, what play could be? And I think that's really a big part of what's unique too about what we do. Because you can look at golf video games, but then you could also go look at a mini golf exhibit and have some fun.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's so interesting. I want to hear so much about the mini golf exhibit. I think something that we talk about a lot is, you know, we've got a very broad player base of, you know, multi-generational and all over the world and different play styles, casual players and serious gamers. And I think a lot of that is based on just what mini golf is, because, you know, one of us can take it really, really seriously. The other can be goofing around and just laughing and not even looking. And we can all, it doesn't really affect one another, right? Like we can all, it's sort of like the spirit of what you're talking about, where it's just very self-directed, very much, you know, like you sort of bring to it what matters to you.
Exactly.
And that seems to, and it's what's happened as a result of that. And I think it is just building on what mini golf is, which is like, it's a little bit of a caricature of golf and other things. And so people come to it with a sense of silliness.
Whoa.
There's silliness for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's seen here, actual size. Thank you, Chris. So already, I think when, you know, you bring anyone onto a mini golf course anywhere, they're sort of like, all right, it's goofy. There's exaggeration. There's silly premises. There's loop-de-loops. I'm not going to take this seriously. So people kind of bring their silliest, most childlike self with them. But also the turn-based nature of it means that, like, while you're playing and focusing on your shot, I can look around. I can learn from you. We can chat. I can sort of learn things there. So it sort of brings us along. And one thing that we've tried to do with, you know, with the you know, what we call it a low poly art style, is it definitely dials into the aesthetic and the performance on these headsets. But also we've made a decision to not get too detailed, not add, you know, bodies and legs, because we feel like people look at one another and you understand the premise. It's like, all right, Chris, he's got glasses. He's got his collar popped up. Cool. Got it. I don't need to see an exact likeness of you. I can accept that as who you are. And then we can sort of get on with the fantasy of the whole thing. So that, I think for us, that's an important sort of piece of it. And of course, people can cosplay as crazy creatures and characters. They can just be someone that they're not in the real world, and that's okay too. But it is something we think about and talk about a lot in terms of how people show up for play.
Yeah, I think you touched on a key part of that is, you know, we can learn through play. We can experiment with kind of who we are. You know, I talk about who we want to be sometimes, or, you know, who we could be if things were different. I think giving that flexibility to the player is really important. Even, you know, in all the exhibits that we do here, you know, we're consciously thinking about, you know, who is it that's going to visit the museum? What is it that they're going to want to do? And can we add something to it that is a bit surprising, because that's a key part of play too.
Yep. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. So tell us how you came to this idea of doing a mini golf exhibition.
Well, we wanted something that would be engaging for summer, and it was a perfect sort of item. And we'd talked about it for a long time. We've done exhibits on real golf history before, but a chance for people to play is essential. And we wanted to have something that was repeatable. So not only repeatable for our guests, but that was modular so that we could reinstall it another summer or rent it to another museum. And mini golf, nine holes, made a perfect concept.
Indeed.
And two, you know, we could talk about the act of playing mini golf as being part of the play, but then, you know, along with that, because we're a collections-based museum, you know, we can have the toys, you know, the Gator golfs back in the day, or the video game mini golfs. You know, there's a ton of those. I think, you know, we can bridge those gaps between all these forms of play and show kind of how they are the same, but also sometimes how they're different too.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, there's a fascinating history of mini golf just as an activity, but also just the ephemera around it, kind of the reasons how it's fit in culturally. It's a fascinating thing for sure. So like, give us some examples of,
wrong way.
Love it. You know, that is really, again, like what I love about mini golf is that it's sort of like there's low stakes in terms of competition. We do have players, and you know, you will see this in real life, two people that take it very seriously, bring their own putter. They've got their shots dialed in, but also it's like it's totally acceptable just to do as you please. That's kind of part of the good fun. So like, give us some examples of some of the other ephemera that you all have as part of this mini golf exhibition.
Well, a natural one were postcards. There are so many mini golf course postcards across the decades, from the teens and 20s right up to almost the present when people no longer do things like send postcards.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't realize. So it's sort of like a tourism road trip sort of thing where you would have visited a tourist town, mini golf course, and wish you were here. Yeah.
So think of the boardwalk in Atlantic City or Coney Island. They had golf courses, mini golf courses, but they were great because they could fit in all sorts of spaces that if there's a vacant lot in the Depression, this was a way to have a moneymaker for you and to make a little money. It was kind of instant cash at that point. And in fact, it was sort of described as a get rich quick kind of opportunity. It's the game that millions will be playing. And then you could play all night as well as, and the neighbors complained that people were playing mini golf into the late night hours.
Yeah, as I understand it, there was a turf innovation that someone made and patented. And that sort of like paved the way for the boom of mini golf, because all of a sudden you didn't have to maintain actual turf and you could sort of run that everywhere. And then it kind of fit into pop culture where there was just sort of a moment where that sort of thing was working. But I have noticed that over the decades that a lot of mini golf courses are, they're kind of side businesses, they're family businesses. They're obviously not big money makers, but they're sort of like, you know, supplementary things that people sort of do, and they become beloved icons in every sort of local town.
And we actually have, I think, what's one of the oldest surviving mini golf courses in the U.S. just down the road from us. So there is actually mini golf history in Rochester, too, that I think most people, even in Rochester, don't realize.
Oh, wow. Sounds like it's worth the trip for sure. And we do have a coconut up in your neck of the woods, so we're sending him on a dispatch to come report on the exhibition. We'll have to get him to that mini golf course as well.
Absolutely. And obviously, if they reach out to us, we're happy to show everything that we do. There's only a fraction of what we have will ever truly be out on display just because of how much we have.
Yeah. I would imagine for sure. So this modular mini golf course and kind of exhibition, is it like, you know, different I've seen there's kind of like these things for parties and fundraisers where there's like modular holes and greens. Is that how it's set up, or how are the obstacles put together for the actual course itself?
Well, we wanted the course to represent the history of mini golf itself. So there are three holes that represent sort of the classic early era of mini golf, fairly simple. Things like, of course, you've got to have windmills and lighthouses and all those kinds of things.
Yep.
And then
there must.
We also have things that take us up to more of the barcade kind of environment with holes that resemble video game sort of tropes.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
I think my favorite is one that looks like a pinball machine. It's actually one of the more difficult holes. The exhibits team did a wonderful job just, you know, creating just the right amount of difficulty that makes you want to keep coming back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That easy to play, hard to master is a real, like, principle in terms of how we do hole design, for sure. But I think, Chris, something you're talking about is something we think about a lot, which is there are those classic mini golf tropes, and we've definitely tried to play on those or subvert those in some instances. But also, it is just sort of like it's an evolving format, you know, and just since we're not bound by real world physics or real estate or, you know, OSHA compliance, we can sort of get away with a little bit more. But I love that everywhere from barcades to heritage places all have their own sort of weird take on what mini golf is and sort of can be. It's great, great fun for sure.
Oh, almost. Oh.
So close.
Now, I should say, this is also Chris's first foray into VR, so...
Which may be gathering rapidly.
Well, it's...
But
it's,
I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, I did not do mini golf whatsoever before this job. I've been here for about 3 years. I mean, not mini golf, but VR, rather. We do try to make a very comfortable experience. You know, it's one-handed, it's slow, it's kind of... self-paced, but it does sort of take a moment to get oriented to the controls and how it all sort of works.
I'm grateful I run into my desk in my office.
Yeah, exactly. My other hand is usually kind of like out, you know, just making sure I'm not going to run into some furniture. One of the things that we've tried to do is make it as accessible as possible, both by being, you know, simple and approachable like mini golf, but also by making it what's called cross-play. So like whether you're playing on a Quest headset or PlayStation or a Pico, we're going to be adding iPhone and iPad versions soon. We've been testing those for a while, that you can play with one another, because we know that people get the most joy out of just playing with what they have, obviously, but playing with each other, people that they know. And not everyone has the same gear or same, you know, technical skills, and so we want to make that as accessible as possible so they can kind of get back to the business of play, so to speak. So I think
that's something that we do a lot too with exhibits. You know, what can we do? We have a large hard of hearing community, deaf community in Rochester. What can we do to make the museum more accessible to them? Same with people with wheelchairs. Can we design games, interactives that, you know, somebody can pull up with a wheelchair? That's something that we find to be really important, because, you know, we say play is universal, but we want to mean it as much as, you know, we say it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we feel really privileged to have people with different disabilities on the team as well as on our beta testers. We actively seek them out to make sure that it isn't just kind of one specific demographic or play style that we're designing to, but that all different kinds of people can kind of give us feedback on how to make that more fun, accessible, and enjoyable, for sure. And we so value that, absolutely. Oh, I think that we're already at the ninth hole. That's incredible. So we'll kind of, you know, when Chris makes it into the hole, that'll sort of like take us up to the scorecard. So this gives us a little moment to kind of, you know, wrap up the conversation for sure. So how long is the exhibition running there in Rochester?
It is running till Labor Day. So there are prime summer months to take advantage of it. And it is a chance for so many people to make the journey and see all the other things that we have at the museum. One of my favorite refrains all around the museum is that people come in and say, I had one of those. And so we're a really relatable museum. As much as I love art museums, very few of us go in and say, oh, it's just like our Monet at home. So being able to see a radio flyer wagon or a G.I. Joe or a Hot Wheels or a Barbie like yours is just a thrill that I'm worthy of a museum paying attention to what I've done in my life.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I love that. And we, you know, we have players all over, so we're definitely hoping that, you know, a good number of people will take the train and go check it out, but also that they may meet up with each other, because we love to get our players together in person to meet one another. It's a great joy as part of our work as well. What other exhibitions are currently showing concurrent with the mini golf exhibition?
Well, one of our most popular exhibits for especially small kids, but also grown-ups as well, is our miniature supermarket. Our local chain is Wegmans, and we just had a makeover of that so that it is perfectly up to date with the brand, and it is so engaging. We have grown-up only nights 4 times a year called Happiest Hour, where you have to be over 21. There are adult beverages, and the grown-ups still want to play in the miniature Wegmans. They can shop at the real one with real money, but they don't get to run the cash register there.
It sounds great.
And for those interested in video games, you know, we have our e-game revolution and pinball exhibits for those that want to play games like that. We currently have a Raceway arcade exhibit full of all sorts of racing arcade games, both new and old. And then we just opened our 90,000 square foot expansion almost a year ago now, which, has two primary galleries related to video games, one of which is High Score, which is centered around our World Video Game Hall of Fame. That's a place where you can go and play and learn about video game history in a way that, you know, I think, you know, elevates the medium. So we looked at, you know, New York City art galleries and that sort of thing, where it's almost, you know, it has a quality to it that even if you don't know the art, you can relate to it. We wanted that same feeling for video games, whether you love video games or you've never played a video game before. Now, the flip side of that is we have Level Up, where you actually get a wristband and it tracks your progress, and you move through a bunch of different interactives inspired by video game history, from a stealth zone to a solve section to some more passive activities for kids, including planting your own garden. So it's a really cool place. You can earn achievements based on our patent-pending periodic table of video game verbs.
Oh, wow. Super cool.
And we recognize classic video games. Andrew, we just inducted, what, 5 new games into the World Video Game Hall of Fame?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big year. So it was the 10th induction class for the World Video Game Hall of Fame. So we inducted, Myst, SimCity, Resident Evil, Ultima, and Asteroids. I got all 5. That's a good day.
That is a very good day.
That's fantastic. Congratulations to you and them both and all the players. Well, I think that's something that, you know, like we think about a lot and is so relevant to what we're both doing, is that, you know, video games can feel so ephemeral, you know, but to the players, they're extremely real. You know, their personas, the memories that they make here, the achievements, the adventures they've gone on together are very real. And so finding ways to commemorate those and preserve them over time are so important. And, you know, we really, while we do have competitive players and they certainly matter to us, we definitely try to send a signal that, you know, anyone is just as much of a star in Walkabout. Just come be a good person, help each other out, approach it with a sense of fun and openness. And your story is worth telling, because, you know, there's only, you know, 10 or 15 people who could, you know, rank in the top scores for the whole game. But anyone can come and have a good adventure, have a good time, have some laughs, And so we really do try to emphasize that in our storytelling, but also in our ephemera and other things. We have, you know, people that recreate our models with 3D printers and hand paint them. There's a kid right now who's recreating our courses, this course actually specifically in Minecraft. He's building it by hand, okay. You know, kind of
amazing.
Block by block. Yeah, and so it's like, be you, you know, celebrate, bring what you want to do. I think that's so much resonates from back on hole one with it's like, we can't tell you how to play. You tell us how you want to play, you know, certainly. So, yeah, it's just, it's so inspiring to see how what people bring to it. They really bring it to life for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially as we think about an international audience, that play is different for everybody. You know, we call ourselves the International Center for the History of Electronic Games. So, you know, it's in some ways easier to collect the American side of things because that's where we are. But then, you know, we have an exhibit on the World of Tanks game and what those tanks actually have a personal meaning to a lot of the players that play that, especially right. those in, you know, Eastern Europe. And you can see that throughout our collection is, you know, we're representing the whole world as much as anything.
Yeah, well, and also the way that a whole lot of game licensing works is sometimes there'll be a game made just for a certain country or continent or region that isn't actually available in the rest of the world. So you can be two decades later and be like, oh, I didn't realize it was a Labyrinth game in Japan in the 80s. It never came out here. We never heard about it, you know? So there's this kind of a sense of discovery that you get from going around the world in that sense.
And my fellow curator, Lindsay, lived in Japan, you know, fluent in Japanese, and she's processing a collection of over 8,000 Japanese games. And there's so much in there that I've never heard of before, and I consider myself a pretty well-versed gamer at the end of the day. but she keeps finding these titles, and it's like, wow, they made that? And it's incredible.
That's so great. That's so good. Mm-hmm.